better blood thinners.
Plant-based therapies for menopause.
What about those dietary habits among Americans?
And sudden cardiac death among children and young adults.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, hosted on June 24th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, too.
Rick, I know you yawned just a little bit over this Journal of the American Medical Association study, taking a look, a comprehensive look, at dietary habits among Americans. But I thought there were a couple things in there that were interesting.
Well, I yawned because it seems like almost every week we're talking about some aspect of diet, but it's an important issue. So I'm glad you picked this particular study. It attempted to plug some holes in our knowledge. We've really not examined the dietary trends among really all U.S. adults over the last 13 or 14 years. So the authors attempted to rectify this. And they did that by looking at several different National Health and Nutrition Examination surveys conducted about every 2 years. They looked at almost 34,000 U.S. adults that were 20 years or older. This is a survey of otherwise healthy people. And they looked at American Heart Association components. What are the recommendations? To eat more total fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, more fish, and to decrease our sugar beverages and sodium. Then secondary things like eating more nuts, seeds, and legumes, less processed meat, and less saturated fat. And here's what they discovered. Over the last 13 years, there have been some dietary improvements, somewhat modest. So for example, if you look at the percentage of people with poor diets, they do less than 40% of what's recommended. That has decreased from 56% of the population to about 46%. But those that actually adhere to a good diet, 80% of the recommendations or more, only about 1.5%. The other thing that was interesting was the improvements took place in primarily two things, a decrease of about 50% in our intake of sweetened beverages and about a 50% increase in our ingestion of whole grains. The disconcerting thing is it didn't apply across the whole population. For example, Hispanics and African Americans weren't as likely to see these benefits, and lower socioeconomic groups weren't as well. So it tells us there have been modest improvements, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Indeed. But I think it also identifies very clearly target populations in whom we really need to get the message out. And we also have seen, as we discussed last week, that there is a benefit to doing it. So well worth undertaking in my mind.
It is. And the population in general, we have less hypertension, the cholesterol's gone down, and we may be plateauing with the obesity rate as well. So there are clearly benefits to the population.
Excellent. Since we're talking about benefits, let's turn to the British Medical Journal. This is a look at these novel anticoagulants. These are those blood thinning agents that we've talked about on a number of occasions in very specific applications. And this takes a much more global look at how helpful they could be.
It does. And as you described them, the novel anticoagulants, or some people call them NOACs, they're often used as a replacement for Coumadin or warfarin. And specifically, the individuals that most commonly take these are people that have a heart condition called atrial fibrillation, where the upper chamber of the heart does not beat synchronously with the lower chamber. In fact, it kind of quivers, and it puts people at risk of having a clot form and dislodge and cause a stroke. And we know that in those individuals, Coumadin can decrease the risk of having a stroke substantially, about 60 or 70%, and decrease mortality by about a third. So these novel anticoagulants may be able to replace warfarin. They have some benefits. One is that you don't have to monitor blood thinning, and that's a major benefit. Some people find them easier to take than warfarin. The question is, are they as effective as warfarin? These investigators looked at over 61,000 patients that had atrial fibrillation taking either warfarin or one of these NOACs. What they discovered was there was no significant difference among them with regard to stroke. However, there were some benefits. Rivaroxaban, one of the NOACs, had a lower risk of the combination of ischemic stroke or systemic embolism, throwing a clot somewhere in the body. And two others, dabigatran and apixaban, had lower bleeding rates. What this tells me is that there are several different agents that someone can choose based upon the patient's preference, their specific condition, and the physician's recommendation.
Let's talk about cost.
In general, warfarin or Coumadin, much less expensive than the other agents. They may be more cost-effective, though, if you take into account things such as how much money you spend on checking whether someone's blood is thin or not, and also if you take into account some of the side effects like bleeding.
And then finally, I believe that we've talked in the past about reversal of these agents if someone is about to have surgery.
We have ways of reversing Coumadin or warfarin using something called vitamin K. There are limited options with regard to these NOACs. There is one new agent out for dabigatran, but for the other ones, there's not.
But sounds to me that in toto, these things are well worth trying in preference to Coumadin, because Coumadin, it is troublesome for people to come in and have to have their blood thinning monitored.
But for some individuals, they don't mind that. They would much rather do that and have the ability to reverse it if they need it. So again, there are trade-offs. I think the message of this is the NOACs are safe and effective alternative in the routine care setting. So well worth considering.
Excellent. Speaking of safe and effective and well worth considering, and I'm going to say maybe, let's turn back to the Journal of the American Medical Association. What about plant-based therapies for menopausal symptoms?
Elizabeth, until I read this study, I was unaware that as many as a half of women in Western countries use complementary therapies to manage the menopausal symptoms. Obviously, menopause is a time where menstrual periods stop permanently, and there's this transition period between menstrual periods to menopause where women can experience hot flashes and night sweats and vaginal dryness. Some women just motor through that, put up with the symptoms, hoping that the duration is short. Other women can't tolerate them. Hormonal therapy based upon estrogen is one option, but we've talked about the fact that it may have some side effects and not be attractive to many women. So they may choose to use plant-based therapies that have an estrogen-like compound called a phytoestrogen, or herbal medicine. So what these investigators did was try to establish, are these really effective or not? And so they looked at randomized clinical trials that assess the different plant-based therapies and how well they treated hot flashes, night sweats, and vaginal dryness. And here's what they discovered. In examining over 62 studies involving over 6,600 women, when phytoestrogens were used, there was a modest decrease in the number of hot flashes. There was a change in terms of vaginal dryness, but it did not decrease the number of night sweats. And then when they looked at other therapies, two others that are frequently used, some Chinese herbal medications and black cohosh, neither one of these seemed to be very effective.
What about using those in conjunction with maybe a reduced hormone therapy kind of a strategy?
That's certainly a strategy that one can use. This only looked at studies in which complementary therapy was used, not combination therapy.
I know lots of women who have a family history of breast cancer, for example, who are really concerned about hormone therapy with regard to menopausal symptoms, really want to try some of these other things. And as you're well aware, these symptoms can be very troubling, sometimes disabling.
Absolutely. One of the things that this study does highlight is we really don't have many studies looking at the long-term effects.
An ongoing issue then. Finally, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, a rather sobering topic, sudden cardiac death among children and adolescents.
And I picked this particular study not just because I'm a cardiologist, because this is a pretty devastating condition. And what the authors attempted to do with the study is to nail down what the incidence is. Fortunately, it's infrequent, but it actually gave some insight into the causes and what is the proper evaluation. So what they did in this study was they collected information on all sudden cardiac death among children and young adults, that is between the ages of 1 to 35, in Australia and New Zealand over a two-year period from 2010 to 2012. Now, these are deaths that weren't explained by drug overdoses, for example, or any other reason. A routine autopsy was performed on these individuals to see if they could establish the cause. And then they added genetic testing as well, which isn't routinely done. And here's what they discovered. Fortunately, the incidence is low. For every 100,000 people in the population, it's about 1.3 individuals that will experience sudden death as a child or young adult. When they looked at autopsy, they were able to establish a cause in about a fourth of the cases. Most of those were coronary artery disease. You say in kids? No, this was usually in the 30 to 35 year old range. That means that about at least 40% of the cases were unexplained. And what they discovered in those individuals, that genetic testing was particularly helpful. They were able to identify a relevant cardiac or heart gene mutation in about 31 of the 113 cases, about a fourth of the cases. And why is that important? Well, because that carries information regarding what I'm going to call first degree relatives, other siblings, for example, or cousins as well. And when they went and looked at individuals, they're often able to say this seminal case, this unexplained death, identified a primary heart issue and other first degree relatives. Other things that were somewhat interesting is that most of these unexplained deaths occurred between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. when the child was at rest. So some of our recommendations that we say, well, people are at risk, shouldn't be involved in regular exercise, that may not protect this particular population.
I think it's really great if we can get some more information on why these things happen. It certainly even brings comfort to people who are trying to cope with these sudden losses.
Absolutely. I mean, to not know and to be concerned, is this something that runs in the family, for example, or other people at risk? Was this something I could have prevented? These are all questions that I think most family members ask in these particular circumstances. The autopsy data can identify oftentimes anatomic issues or cardiac issues, but in those in which it's unexplained, genetic testing can be very helpful.
Okay. On that note then, I'm going to talk about the novel anticoagulants this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.